Good afternoon. Well, thank you for coming, and thank you for giving up this lunchtime to be here. Can you trust the Bible? I wonder if that is a question that is high up on your agenda. I guess sometimes when people ask it to me, it's in less neutral terms. It's usually in something that's sort of incredulous. You can't believe the Bible, can you? Something a bit more antagonistic or hostile. And I guess behind that are a whole range of different motivations and questions and issues. And obviously we've just got 20 minutes to address just a handful. But I guess if you come to this question, can you trust the Bible? The first thing one's got to establish is, what are you trusting the Bible for? What are you expecting it to do? And if you do decide that you can trust the Bible, what are you going to do about that? Are you then going to put your trust in it to do those things that you expect? Now, I can think of probably at least 101 different things for which trusting the Bible would be a very foolish move. So, for instance, perhaps I'd like to print out one of my favourite verses on a piece of paper and sort of laminate it and something and expect that to act as some sort of lucky charm. Well, I can trust it for that, but that's probably a foolish thing to do. Or perhaps, as sometimes people do this, they sort of open the Bible at random, pick out any verse that sort of springs off the page and use that as sort of, I don't know, divine guidance for the day. I'd suggest that that is pretty foolish as well. Some people expect great things of the Bible that actually it's not necessarily designed to produce. So, for instance, they might turn to the Bible expecting a scientific textbook that explains the details of everything from human blood circulation to complex mathematical theory. Now, of course, the Bible does touch on a variety, a huge range of scientific subjects, apart from anything else. But it's usually from a very different, but I would suggest, complementary angle. But you can't expect the Bible to do something that actually only books written in the last 30 years have done. And perhaps for some others, they expect the Bible to corroborate their beliefs and points of view. So they're looking for an endorsement of the way they think about the world. Well, it's hardly likely to do that, is it? And yet it's funny, isn't it, how quick we're to get stroppy with the Bible when we don't agree with it or dislike some of the things it's saying. We assume that it's got to fit with my way of thinking. Now, can I trust the Bible for these things? Well, definitely not. The issue is, what does the Bible claim for itself? Expecting it to do anything else would be like expecting me to carry you across the Niagara Falls in a wheelbarrow when I only offer to take you to Tesco's. It would be absolutely ludicrous and way beyond what was expected. Now, of course, one of the problems with tackling this subject is just the sheer size of the book we're talking about. The Bible is a unique book in many ways. I've put some stats on your sheets, and I'm not going to cover everything on the sheets. It's more for you to take it away and think about. But just a few basic facts about it. It's made up of 66 books. It's one book, but it's more like a sort of anthology, really. 39 in the Old Testament, 27 in the New. But these books were written over a period of, well, around 1,500 years, a millennium and a half, by more than 40 different authors from every walk of life: kings, farmers, philosophers, fishermen, poets, soldiers, politicians, you name it. Written in different circumstances, in prison, in palaces, in deserts, in cities, in war, in peace, in anguish and joy, just a whole range of human experience, on three continents, Asia, Africa, and Europe, in at least three different languages, Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek, and in all kinds of different types of literature: poetry, law-giving, history, prophecy, letters, visions, proverbs, and so on. It's a vast, extraordinary, unique collection. And you might ask, where do you begin? With so much variety, of course, you'd expect the different books to have different purposes, and you'd be right, they do. So each of these 66 books contributes something unique and unusual to the whole. And that's one of the things that one needs to be aware of. And so in some ways, yes, the Bible is a glorified anthology drawn from across the centuries. But it's far more. And amazingly, for all its twists and turns, there is a consistent message through it. And if I had to summarize what that message was, I'd put it something like this. It's a record of God's activity and purposes in his world. Now, it doesn't say everything about what God is up to, of course. But it's the key points. Now, maybe you think that is absolutely ridiculous. That's totally far-fetched. What God, if he's there, is doing is recorded in this book. That seems ridiculous. Well, I'm not going to even attempt to convince you of that in just 20 minutes. I've set my sights much lower. I simply want to make three simple points that I think and hope will provoke further thought, investigation, and questions. And the first is simple: the claims of history. Now, what is it that has made Dan Brown an incredibly wealthy man? Yes, he writes books that lots of people buy, but the Da Vinci Code and the other sequels and other books, through these, he's attacked all kinds of aspects of traditional Orthodox Christianity, and particularly the Bible, and in particular, when it comes to the Bible, its historical reliability. And people have lapped it all up, and it's just spewed a whole load of other things that people have written on the back of it and, you know, made a fast buck in so doing. And I think partly people have lapped it up because it gives, to be fair, I think a get-out clause from taking the Bible seriously. It's a convenient way of avoiding the issue. Now, I, of course, haven't got time to go into every detail, but we've got to start somewhere. So I want to start with Luke. He was a medical doctor who wrote two books in the Bible, in the New Testament, his gospel, named after him, and the book of Acts, which is a sequel. So the first one is focused mainly on Jesus, and the book of Acts follows a small number of Jesus' followers as they travel around. Now, Luke is a good place to start, I think, for this topic, because he is quite explicit in telling us what he's doing. Charmaine read that little passage, as we've heard. You've got it there on the sheets as well. And I wonder if you picked up how Luke makes quite a point of being an investigator. He's investigating the key events behind his books, and you can see that in verse 3. I've carefully investigated everything. So he's visited the right places. He's talked to the right people. He's read the different reports. He's the first to admit that he wasn't an eyewitness. He wasn't the one of the group who originally spent time with Jesus. But he's talked to all those who were. And now he's writing his own account for this friend Theophilus, whoever he was. Maybe it's a secret cover name, or it's his genuine name, or it could be any person, because Theophilus literally means lover of God. So it could be anyone who wants to know God better. But the important thing is, as far as Luke is concerned, he wants to get the dates and the historical details right. So, for example, through the gospel, he's keen to tell us who the Roman officials at that particular juncture were, who was on the throne in Rome, the kings in Judea, and so on. He wants us to see his account as historically reliable. Now, the reason is that he's presenting what God is doing in his world. That's what he thinks he's doing, at any rate. What God is doing in his world, in time, in space. He's not some sort of remote, distant figure. He is a God who is active. And actually, in Luke's gospel, as far as Luke is claiming, this God is a God who gets his hands dirty and his feet muddy in the person of Jesus Christ. But the important thing for now is that, as far as Luke is concerned, it happened in time and space. Now, despite what Dan Brown and others say, the extraordinary thing is that the New Testament has far greater historical credibility than it is often given credit for. It should be given far greater credit. I could take a whole load of different angles on this, but I wonder if you realize that archaeology has never seriously or significantly disproved the Bible. It just simply hasn't. That seems a completely overstretched claim, I'm sure. And you know, I remember when I first heard that, I thought, come on, that seems absurd. But the fact remains that what people have dug up at various points around the Mediterranean and elsewhere, what people have dug up is either silent on what the Bible affirms or states, or it corroborates it. Now, occasionally people dig up something and they think, oh, this is the final clue, this clinches it, this disproves the Bible. But the interesting thing is, time and time again, academic convention is overturned and the Bible is proved right. Now, I'll just give you one tiny example of this. It's very small, it's not a big deal, you can't build a whole sort of edifice on it, but it's just an interesting indicator. In Luke's second book, the Acts of the Apostles, Luke describes the Apostle Paul visiting the city of Thessalonica in northern Greece. And in Acts chapter 17, Luke describes some of the city officials as politarchs. And that comes from two Greek words, polis meaning a city, archos meaning a ruler. Now, you might think, what's the big deal with that? Well, the significant thing is that you will not find that word politarch anywhere else in the entire corpus of Greek literature. It's never used. And so for ages, people thought Luke had made this word up. You know, you won't find it in sort of classical Athens Greek or anything like that. It's just not used. And they assumed, oh, well, you know, just yet another example of Luke's inaccuracies. Just made up this word willy-nilly. But relatively recently, various inscriptions have been dug up on, you know, plaques, on arches and so on around Greece. And they've discovered that this word has been used as a formal title. And there are now in existence in museums around the world 19 different examples of this. And guess what? 5 of them were dug up in Thessalonica. One of which is in the British Museum. There it is. You can go and see it for yourself just down the road. Now, that is a tiny point, and I don't want to make a huge store out of it. I simply want to say this, because, you see, if Luke can be trusted for the tiny details, you know, here is a tiny incidental detail that he needn't have used. It probably indicates that he did go there, and that this was a term he picked up when he was in Thessalonica as something unique to that town. He thought, okay, in my description, I'll use that word to describe councillors or whatever. If he can be trusted for the little details, well, perhaps, actually, the bigger picture is something we can trust him for as well. I'm sure you'll know of C.S. Lewis from mainly, I guess, these days from the Narnia books and films. But I hope you're aware that, actually, he was a world-class literary critic. He was a tutor, a lecturer at Oxford University for years in English literature and then ended up as professor of English literature at Cambridge. But he wrote this about the gospel accounts, the four gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. He noted this. I've been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, and myths all my life. I know what they're like. I know none of them are like this, that is the gospels. Of this gospel text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, or else some unknown ancient writer without known predecessors or successors suddenly anticipated centuries in advance the whole technique of modern novelistic realistic narrative. In other words, what he's saying is that this idea of writing fiction in a way that gives the impression of, you know, sort of historical description and so on, without sort of filling in all kinds of other sort of literary details and so on, wasn't invented for centuries. He is suggesting that actually when you read the Gospels, they sound and feel much more like reportage. So if they are reportage, what are they reporting? What is at the center? If Luke can be trusted on the small points, what's the big point he's trying to make? Well, secondly then, I think it's this issue of the centrality of Jesus. I wonder if you noticed in those verses how Luke talked about what he was describing as a case of fulfillment, or fulfilled, these things fulfilled certain things. Now, that's an interesting word. But you see, for Luke's central contention is that Jesus is the fulfillment of many prophecies and promises to be found in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish scriptures. Now, again, I'm not expecting you to believe that necessarily straight away. I'm simply making the point that for Luke, that's what he thought was going on. These events that he's describing about Jesus were fulfillments of things written long before, centuries even before. Basically, Luke is simply making the point that this is big news. The arrival of Jesus onto the world stage is big. That's why he keeps quoting the Old Testament. He's saying, it's happening. And that is why he resolutely focused on Jesus. Jesus is the center of his story and the reason for his writing. Luke is clear that all this happened and insists that he did not make it up. That's why he makes a point of saying, look, I talked, I investigated, I read. Just one thing perhaps needs saying here. Please do not swallow what I would call the myth of objectivity. What I mean by that is this. Don't believe that just because Luke was an insider, in other words, just because he was a believer, because he was a Christian, that therefore he can't be trusted to be reliable and honest. Well, of course he was a believer. That's why he's telling the story. You can't expect otherwise. You have to have an angle if you're writing about Jesus. You either believe him or you don't. So, you know, anyone is going to have an angle on him. You can't be absolutely objective, but that does not mean you can't be reliable or credible. There's a big difference. So by all means, come with questions, with doubts, with even skepticism. By all means. No one wants to be taken for a ride or exposed as gullible. But check this out, or rather, check him out. Because you see, in the end, whatever you say about the whole Bible will depend almost entirely on what you say about Jesus. Don't allow your skepticism to blind you just to the possibility that Jesus just might be who Luke and the rest of the Bible claims him to be. He just might be. The interesting thing is that Luke understands such skepticism. He understands that sometimes this is hard to grasp. And so he writes, I wonder if you noticed in verse 4 to Theophilus, he says, I want you to know the certainty of what you've been taught. Presumably because Theophilus was struggling to get his head around all this. And many did. Even Jesus' closest friends and family even found it hard to understand Jesus, certainly to begin with. And Luke's not afraid to show that. He's not too afraid to show that sometimes, you know, these are big things to get your heads around. But he takes the reader on a journey through Jesus' extraordinary ministry. We don't get all the details. We don't get the whole life story. This is not biography in the traditional sense. You know, you don't go into all kinds of psychology of his parents or anything like that. No, Luke takes us to the central point and uses narrative details to bring us to that. And that is that Jesus is God himself living within his creation. Which is a staggering thing to claim, isn't it? That's massive. Now, if that is true, then you can see why Luke would want to write about it. If it is true, then suddenly everything that Jesus does and even says takes on a profound significance, including what he says about the Bible, and he does talk about the Bible. And certainly the scriptures that he had, which is our Old Testament. I think it is fair to say, in fact, that you can open the New Testament on any page, and find the pervasive assumption being that Jesus is who Luke claims him to be. I guarantee it, any page in the New Testament, you can open it up, and that will be the assumption behind it. And he is the fulfillment of everything before, and the one who reveals God to the world in the present. More than that, actually, he is the one through whom God comes to rescue the world, because actually the whole of the Bible story is not simply about God showing himself. It's actually about how God showing how to come back to him. That's what the Bible is all about, all the way through, what God's doing in his world, ultimately through Jesus. So can you trust the Bible? Well, it depends what you're expecting it to do. I would say this, though. You can trust it absolutely to let you know what God's doing in his world in Jesus. He stands resolutely at its center. You will have heard of the great German reformer, Martin Luther. And he put it like this. The Bible is the cradle in which the infant Jesus lies. Don't let us inspect the cradle and forget to worship the baby. He resolutely stands at the center. And that leaves me with a very simple point. The challenge to read it. It's amazing, isn't it? I find a lot in my job that people come and talk to me and ask questions about the Bible, and they've sort of adopted and swallowed other people's doubts and skepticism and actually haven't read it themselves. It's still sort of gathering dust on the shelf at home, if it's there at all. Now, as I've said, it's a massive book, 66 books. In fact, where do you begin? And I guess for some, an obvious approach is to start with Genesis and start plowing on through. And for many, I think, you know, Genesis is quite exciting, Exodus has got its fun, but then they get pretty bogged down in Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy. Now, I am not stopping anyone reading that. I think there's some fascinating stuff in there, and it really repays reading. But I think, actually, one needs a sort of way in, and there is a better way in than just starting at the beginning in this case, and that is to start in the middle with Jesus, to start with him. So take the Gospels, one of the four. Take Luke or Mark's Gospel. That's what the Christianity Explore course uses as its way in. Start there, and if you like, work outwards, backwards to the Old Testament and forwards to the rest of the New Testament. Because actually, you cannot understand fully all that's going on in Mark's Gospel without what's gone before. But you can get the general thrust, you can get the general heart of it, and that is, you can be introduced to Jesus. But the key thing is to start. To read it. Keep asking yourself, why is this here? And can I honestly believe this? It's a fair question. We're not wanting to pull wool over anybody's eyes. If I can't, why not? If I can't believe it, why can't I believe it? Well, are my reasons legitimate? Question those reasons. Question those reasons for believing it as well. Am I honestly doing this in the right and honest way? We've all got our doubts. We've all got our questions. They're inevitable. Life is complex. But check that these doubts are not sort of from an inherited skepticism or a second-hand doubt. Make sure they're yours, that your doubts, if you like, have integrity and your questions come from a solid foundation. And read with just be open to the possibility that it just might be credible and just might matter rather a lot. One American Christian leader 100 years ago, Dwight Moody, said this: "The Bible was not given to increase our knowledge, it was given to change our lives." Now, that's quite a big statement. Well, the way I think it changes our lives is by presenting us with Jesus and a life that revolves not around myself, but around him. It's like a sort of Copernican revolution. Instead of having me at the center of my universe, or, you know, like in this sort of old Middle Age worldview where the earth was the center of the universe, there's a revolution needs to take place where I suddenly realize I'm not at the center, somebody else is. Well, as far as the Bible is concerned, it's God. Jesus. Now, there can be all kinds of reasons why I might not want to do that. I might not want Jesus getting up close and personal. I don't want someone else looking over my shoulder into the sort of darker recesses of my life. I don't want God to get involved with my life. I'm quite happy with him at arm's length. But if that is the case, be honest, admit it. I think it takes a great step of courage to start reading the Bible with an open mind. But surely it's a step worth taking because it's an invitation, it's a door into a larger world. To suddenly see that actually this world has purpose and meaning and direction for all its fraught pains and agonies and difficulties. That suddenly the ceiling is lifted off and suddenly the world is a far bigger, greater, amazing place. And after all, no one wants to be accused of having a closed mind, do they?